You want some sexy? You want to laugh? License to Talk.
License to Talk is brought to you by First in Buffalo. Fireman owned and operated. Custom apparel. Custom hats. 389 Abbott Road. Get your custom gear at First in Buffalo. Dog Ears Bookstore. Stop into the cafe and bookstore and enjoy a welcoming hometown atmosphere, all while supporting programs that spread creativity and literacy throughout South Buffalo and beyond. Don't get your coffee from Timmy when you can get it from Tommy. Charlie's Boatyard, 1111 Furman Boulevard. Come and enjoy a nice cold drink and a beautiful sunset. All right, Marky, episode 86, we have on the line Dan Egan. He is a two-time Pulitzer Prize-nominated journalist and author. He's been described as a beat reporter for the Great Lakes. His books are The Death and Life of the Great Lakes, and his newest book, The Devil's Element, Phosphorus, and World Out of Balance. Dan Egan, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you guys doing?
Good, good. Good. You know, we're here. We're basically two beer-drinking guys, ham and eggers, who watch football and care about our lake. And we're over here on Lake Erie, and you seemed like to be a good guest to have here today.
Yeah, I think I'd fit in with you, too.
Yeah, Packers. Are you a Packers fan?
Oh, yeah. I was born in Green Bay.
Yeah, oh. Tough loss yesterday.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, yeah. I thought about going up there. I live in Milwaukee, so it's a couple hours away. So it's a long day, but you know, it's worth it if they win.
Yeah.
Are you guys more of a college town or a pro town?
Green Bay?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, so I went to school at the University of Michigan. I grew up in Green Bay. And, I really got that vibe when I left Wisconsin for Michigan, that the Packers, because I went to a couple Lions games over there, and I was like, ugh. I mean, this is back in the mid-late 80s. But I think Green Bay, just the fan base and the revelry and the tradition, it all kind of echoes a college game more than some of these slick NFL franchises.
I want to get right into the book, The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. That's a powerful title. And explain to the listeners where this comes from.
Not me.
Not you.
So, let me think here. The Death and Life of the Great Lakes is kind of a riff on a book, Death and Life of the Great American Cities, that came out in like the 1960s, which was really, really critical of just the way cities were getting, you know, neighborhoods were getting paved over and interstates were carving up, you know, communities. And I was really not familiar. I mean, I was aware of that book, and I think I read some chapters from it when I was an undergraduate. But the decision to kind of play off that original title came from the publisher, W.W. Norton. I had originally thought that it would be Liquid Desert, because I had a different opening chapter to that book, and it was the last commercial fisherman in Milwaukee going out with him and his dad like one last time before he moved to Alaska, where he could catch more fish in a day, pound wise, than he could catch all year on Lake Michigan, because the fishery had been, you know, so devastated. But that chapter they thought was a little too parochial, a little too local or regional, and the book was getting long, and so they pulled that, hence my working, because that's what he referred to the lake as, a liquid desert. And when that chapter went, so went the title. I'm not complaining about Death and Life of the Great Lakes. I think it's a good title. And the longer it's out there, the more it just seems like it had to be that.
Yeah, like I love how you're like not a scientist, you know. So like us being like just bros, you know, the way that you get to some of your stories is like it's awesome. You know, like in the new book, how like with the astronaut.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Wait, how did you come across this story?
Yeah, you know, the internet. I was actually, there's a lot that got left on the cutting floor in that book. I spent a lot of time looking at that mine in Western Sahara, and I was actually trying to, I actually ended up contacting a guy in Sweden who has some phosphate rock dust from that mine. And I had hoped to go there myself, but COVID came, and it's also really kind of a dodgy place to go, especially if you're a family man such as I got four kids.
Yeah.
I've got to prioritize things. But yeah, so anyway, I was trying to get as close as I could with a satellite, and I was looking at an image just from Google Earth, and that kind of put me down the path to some NOAA site, and there was a picture of this, it's called Bukhra phosphate mine in Western Sahara. And it was taken by an astronaut aboard the space station. So I tracked him down and interviewed him. And it turned out that, you know, he loves taking pictures of famous raceways on his, you know, hours off, as much as we get him up there in space. But he was, I think, hoping to shoot like, what was the race? It was a race in France. And they're going like 22,000 miles an hour or something. So they're zipping over Africa, and he's getting ready to get his picture in France. And he looks down and sees this just land sculpture on the ground, is how he explained it. And it was actually this massive rock mine that provides fertilizer that grows the food that keeps humanity humming along. So, yeah, I mean, West. Go ahead.
No, yeah, that you just like see this from space. I'm sorry, we've learned out of these phone interviews, we cut people off a lot. Don't take it personal. Just keep going.
No problem.
Yeah, no, but like, yeah, like, and you wind it back all the way into this book. It's like, you know, it's very cool how, you know, even the story with the girl from the, you know, the desert. Like, did you actually talk to this girl?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. She was Najla. I can't remember her last name. She was at junior college in Washington State, and she was, I haven't talked to her in 2 or 3 years, but she was going back to her refugee camp because most of the native people of the Sahara Desert got basically pushed out when Morocco occupied that big sweep of African sand in the 1970s when Spain pulled out of Western Sahara. It was one of Spain's colonies, and Morocco filled the void, and many of the native people got exiled, including the family of this young woman. And so her grandmother, you know, started living in a tent on the Algerian Western Saharan border back in the mid 1970s. And at the time they thought it would be just, you know, a few weeks, a month or two until things calmed down. And now it's been a half century. And so her mom was born in the camp, I believe. She's born in the camp. That's all they know. So yeah, I tracked her down because she's a pretty forceful voice for the rights of the native people of Western Sahara, and specifically for the rights to that phosphate mine, which is currently owned and operated by the Moroccan government. Wow. So, yeah.
I found it fascinating, her reaction to seeing, and that's where we're going to tie us in, to water. She thought the whole world was a desert.
Yeah, they don't have, you know, we don't have like a traditional drinking water system in this tent camp. And I call it a camp, but I think there's three of them, and there's more than 100,000 people living like this. So all their water has to be shipped in. They don't have, you know, any kind of modern sanitation. And yeah, water is really, really precious. And so when she was a kid, some part of a program took her over to Spain, I believe, for like a summer camp. When she saw a swimming pool with people splashing in water, you know, she was just flabbergasted, because as she explained, it's like water is sacred. I mean, if you spill a drop, you get scolded. And here there's kids doing cannonballs off of high dives. You know, it just blew her mind away.
And you talk, and that's how we're going to tie us in. You became a beat writer for the Great Lakes. And that, is that how this all started? I know that you were in Salt Lake City for a little while, and then you get shipped up. And is that where this passion starts? Obviously, you're just like us. You grew up on the lake, so you appreciate the lake. But talk about, you become a beat reporter, and that's where this journey starts a little bit, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I was, you know, working at newspapers in Idaho, and I worked in Sun Valley, Idaho, and then in Idaho Falls, Idaho, and then went down to Salt Lake City and worked at the Salt Lake Tribune. And I was covering some environmental issues, but I was doing a lot of feature writing. I covered a lot of issues related to the Mormon Church when I was in both Idaho and Utah, particularly in Utah. When I moved back after more than 10 years out there, moved back to Wisconsin to take a job at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And I, you know, out what I'm talking about out in Utah and Idaho, that was a desert. And you live in a desert for a decade, and then you come back to the shores of, you know, a great lake. You look at that lake in a whole different light. And so when they hired me, it wasn't to be a Great Lakes environment reporter or anything like that. I was just a feature writer. But for some reason, I kept writing about the lake over and over again. And finally, the editor said, well, why don't you just make this your beat? And I think I was writing about the lake over and over again because, yeah, just like you guys, I grew up on the shores of Lake Michigan, and I was fortunate enough to have two sets of grandparents who had summer homes on or near Northern Green Bay, which is an arm of Lake Michigan. And I spent a lot of time up there as a kid, and that obviously imprinted on me somewhere, somehow. And so when I came back, I just kind of slipped into this beat. And as you mentioned earlier, I'm not a scientist, not close to it. So I really, you know, that's a strength and a weakness, and you've got to recognize that and manage as best you can. And I tried to turn it into a strength by being the, you know, lowest common denominator, just being, you know, asking the questions that, you know, an average person would ask, assuming nothing, you know, as far as people understanding how the Great Lakes functioned and worked. And I think that recipe worked pretty well. I got a good example of, you know, realizing that I was on, you know, if not the right path, a not bad path when I was being edited early on one of these long stories. I think I was doing it on the history of the St. Lawrence Seaway, and the editor, a very sharp person, just couldn't, I was explaining how the lakes flowed, and he just couldn't get his head around it. And I didn't understand why he wasn't understanding this paragraph. And then it became apparent that he thought that Niagara Falls tumbled in from the ocean instead of out to the ocean. And when I realized that, I thought, wow, you know, that's good news for being a reporter, because people don't understand this at all. You got to talk to them like fifth graders, which is how, you know, good journalism is often done. So, yeah, I approach it from an every person's perspective. And I think that's what helped, you know, help that beat put food on my table for a couple of decades before I moved on from the newspaper.
Yeah, like for us, like we're putting together like this podcast, and you know, we always are looking like, is there a common thread that we have? Like, we don't know, you know. And you kind of took your thread. When did you think it was going to become a book?
Well, so my editor was really encouraging me to write a book after about 8 or 9 years, because the way that beat, such as it was, worked, I didn't just do stories every day on what's going on Lake Michigan. They were big issue-driven pieces that would take 6 to 9 months to do. And I would be doing, you know, some daily coverage along the way, but my focus was one big kind of package a year, which I didn't know it at the time, but those were like book chapters. And my editor at the newspaper kind of recognized that before I did. And he said, you should turn this all into a book. And I didn't really have any interest in doing that, because my job was demanding and fulfilling, and my obligations to my family were not small. I just didn't feel like I had the time. But then, in 2011, my wife and I took our four kids out to New York. I did a fellowship at Columbia University. And part of that fellowship was a book writing seminar. And part of that seminar required me to put together a book proposal. So that was the first time I looked at all this pile of work and, you know, said, well, are these chapters and do they fit together? Or can I make them fit together? And I kind of hashed that out through one of the semesters out in New York with a couple of professors. And so by the time I left Columbia in spring of 2012, I had lined up an agent, and it took a long time for that agent to feel comfortable about the book proposal that I had done. He thought I was just being too local and not national or international enough in perspective. So I worked on that proposal for that book for about a year, and then took a couple of years to put those newspaper articles into between two covers, basically. So that's how I kind of fell into book writing. And that book came out in 2017, and like within 6 months, they're like, what else do you got?
And, oh, wow. Yeah. Like onto the next thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it takes a lot out of you doing something like that. And you kind of don't want to go right back into it.
Right. They didn't realize that the beat was a long time. Like you're writing these stories a long time.
Right, right. Yeah, that Great Lakes book is, you know, that's a decade's worth of work. There was a book that just fascinated me when I was out west called Cadillac Desert. Mm-hmm. And I would every once in a while take a peek at it while I was writing the Great Lakes book, and I would just get discouraged and distraught because it was so good and so comprehensive. And I was just like, I don't know how you do this. And then I learned that he spent a decade on it. And I'm like, okay, that's how you do
that
this.
That makes sense. Yeah. What you brings me back to reality is Bukowski. I'm like, oh, if anybody can write, listen to this guy.
Well, yeah, and this kind of stuff, you don't have to be smart. You just have to be, like, determined.
Well, you're very clever at your storytelling, and it, like, immersed me, you know. It's very cool, and I tell everybody all the time, like, pick up these books, you know. You really do have, like, a good way to take, like, just guys, you know. Explaining data. Like, did you have like a drunk buddy that you send it to? And he's like, take the numbers out, man.
Well, not just one.
Like, but I don't understand numbers.
You know, I do find, like, if you know you're just shooting breeze in a bar and you start telling stories about, you know, like the history of the salmon stocking program or the history of how the Seaway got built, and people are like interested, you know, that's who I'm writing for, just the people, you know, at the end of the bar. And and so I do sound out material and, you know, sometimes even structural things with people who are anything but writers, because I'm called you have to be called a writer or an author if you've written a book, but I don't walk around, you know, think of myself as a writer or an author. Just,
yeah,
you know,
because like
a journalist.
Right.
When you are hitting this beat, putting these stories together, what's the number one eye-opening thing covering the Great Lakes that you first discovered?
Okay, so I was saying that I was out in Idaho, and part of my job out there was covering snake and Columbia River sockeye and Chinook salmon, which have just been decimated by all the hydroelectric dams that kind of plug the route for the fish to make it to and from the ocean, because, you know, they're born in the mountains of Idaho and spend their adult life out in the Pacific and then come back and spawn and on and on and on. But the dams were choking that off. And so the first year I was out working at that newspaper, I went to this vigil high in the Sawtooth Mountains, which is like, I'm going to get this wrong, but I think it's 900 miles inland and it's like 7,000 feet above sea level. These fish would make it back historically by the tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, to this little redfish lake. And it was its own, you know, distinct species. And when I got there in 1992, those dams had so choked the flow or the pathway to the ocean that there was one fish that made it back to Redfish Lake. They called him Lonesome Larry. And they stripped him of his milt, of, you know, his sperm, and put it into a captive breeding program they had at one of the state hatcheries. So, you know, those fish were swirling down the drain of extinction. And then I moved back to Wisconsin, and I'm walking on the Milwaukee lakefront one September Saturday in 2002. And there's just hundreds of fishermen right on the, you know, the piers and the wharfs right in downtown Milwaukee. And I, you know, growing up here, I knew that salmon were in the lake, but I didn't know that they were planted there and that it was basically part of this, you know, put and take fishery that we created in the 1960s. And so that was kind of an aha moment. It's like, well, I need to know more about this. And I went back to the newspaper and suggested I do a story on the salmon stocking. And the main editor said, well, everybody knows that story. And here we go. Let's go back to the end of the bar. I keep talking to people. And, you know, they have no idea. And that's half of what your job is as a reporter, is to figure out what might be of interest to people and what they don't know, or what they think they know and they don't. And so I went back to him, you know, like a month later, and made the pitch again. And he said, well, if you're going to do this, let's start at the very beginning. Like, you know, what were these lakes like in their native state? And so, yeah, it was the salmon that were, you know, so that Saturday down on the Milwaukee lakefront, they were, the fish were like finning their way up boat ramps. And, you know, because spawners are always ever swimming upstream. And, you know, it was very unnatural behavior, because I'd seen Chinook salmon spawning in Idaho, and this was not what it looked like. And so I was asking the fishermen, and they're like, no, these things are born to be caught. They're not spawning on the boat ramp. So, yeah, so the fish kind of, and I'm not a fisherman myself. I mean, I'm not averse to it, but I don't have, like, In our garage, we have like a bunch of fishing poles. I don't know whose is whose, whatever.
Yeah, there isn't a special one.
No, maybe with all of them, you get one to work. And yeah. So I didn't come at it from that kind of background either. I just saw the salmon as a vehicle to kind of tell the larger story of the Great Lakes.
Well, yeah, because I'll tell you how I came across your book. And we interviewed the lieutenant colonel of the Army Corps of Engineers. And he has the troubles of coming across his desk are crazy, you know, like levels of the lake. He's like, people think we control this.
Yeah.
So he's do you remember
his name?
Yes, Kobe Krug.
Okay, no, I haven't worked with him.
Oh,
okay.
We'll get you in touch with him.
Yeah, he's
great.
He's awesome. He's like actually a neighborhood guy, and then he actually just ended up, you know, being right on our water, you know.
Oh, cool.
So he was talking, you know, and we said, you know, what's the biggest problem that you see? And, you know, and he brought up Toledo. And that's, so when he started talking about Toledo, you know, then I was walking through the bookstore and I saw your book and I was like, oh, you know, it was pretty interesting what we're talking about. If I could explain it myself, I'd say that like you showed all the things that we've done wrong and how we fixed it to this point. And then at the end, I think you ended it with like saying that you're going out on the lake with your son and it's, you know, we're doing an all right job right now. But then this phosphorus question coming in at the end.
Yeah. And the phosphorus, you know, I did a lot of work on that in the Great Lakes book for a chapter I did on Toledo and Western Lake Erie specifically. So that, that became the second book. And it's a hard sell. Like the publisher, they were keen on it. But, you know, when you tell somebody you're writing a book about phosphorus, you get a pretty blank look on their face. You know, it's
you crack it open and
the
way you even open the book is like we were saying it's like modern pop culture.
Yeah, well, you know, I was, you know, keenly aware of the fact that I was writing about phosphorus and this is not just a naturally sexy topic.
Yeah.
So I've got to engage people and you know, you got to start come out of the gate hard. And so that's what I was doing with the phosphorus book and the police chase and the guy who ended up almost dying in that canal down in Cape Coral.
Our listeners got to get this and read this story, how he opens the book. It's great.
Yeah. You know, that I went to Florida probably 5 times in reporting that book. And I remember I got back on like a Sunday and on a Tuesday, I have a Yahoo email account. So to get to my email, I have to go to Yahoo and you get that Yahoo news. And there's a story about this guy, and there was body cam footage, the police chasing after the guy, and then he jumped in this algae-plagued canal, poisonous algae, and he almost dies. And I had been to, I think at that point, Florida 3 times, and, you know, I was like, I was happy that I found this and could get the footage myself and was exposed to it, but was bummed that I had just gone to Florida, and the best thing I got about the trip, out of the trip, you know, was opening my email 2 days after I got back and seeing that news story of the fugitive in the phosphorus.
Explain so, to the, we got a lot of guys that are sitting at the end of their own bar in their basement listening right now. Explain to them phosphorus.
So phosphorus is it's an element and it's one of 3 crucial elements to modern crop fertilizer. The other 2 being nitrogen and potassium. And we're not really in danger of running out of nitrogen or potassium anytime soon because most of the air we breathe is nitrogen, and for the last century or so, we've had technology that can pull that nitrogen out of the air and turn it into a form suitable for fertilizing crops. There's still vast deposits of potassium scattered around the globe, but phosphorus rocks are different. They're pretty scarce, and they're not evenly distributed around the world, and we're running low on the stuff, and people don't realize how essential it is to, you know, a functioning planet with 9 billion human people on it. Without phosphorus mines, there's no way we'd have this many people here. And so it's really kind of this miracle substance, but it has a downside, that's devilish side. That's why the book's The Devil's Element. And that it not only helps things that we want to grow, like corn and soybeans and wheat, it also grows stuff we don't want. And it fuels these toxic algae blooms that have plagued, like you mentioned, Toledo, which lost its drinking water supply for several days back in 2014 because phosphorus triggered this toxic algal bloom and that toxin made its way into the city drinking water system. And this is dangerous stuff. It you know, in Brazil, in I think it was the late 90s, it got into the water supply at a dialysis center and killed dozens of people. It's been blamed for killing a kid here in Wisconsin who went for a swim on a hot summer night on a golf course. And, you know, one of those ponds that are just green as paint, he jumped into it. And I talked to the pediatrician who treated him just 2 weeks ago. I was at a book talk and he came up and introduced himself to me. And he said, yeah, he was perfectly healthy until he took that swim. And so, yeah, this is not stuff to be trifled with. And we've just got to figure out how to do better. So there's this paradox where the U.S. reserves are primarily in Florida, and those are going to play out, they say, in 3 or 4 decades, at which point we're going to have to go hunting. There's some other deposits, like in, I think, North Carolina and Montana, but they're quite limited compared to what we've been getting out of Florida. So we're probably going to be dependent on another country for our nutritional security, which is arguably a lot dicier and more important than energy security, because there's workarounds to oil, but there's no substitute for phosphorus. It's in every living cell on the planet. Life would not exist without it. And it's only been for the last 100 years or so that we figured out that there's these rock deposits, which are really just, you know, the crude dead life of, you know, little organisms raining down on the ocean floor for hundreds of millions, if not billions of years. And that becomes sedimentary rock. And then that rock, through tectonic forces or whatnot, geologic forces, heaves its way or gets heaved, you know, onto land, and we can mine it. And we're blowing through those reserves really fast. At the same time, we're poisoning our water with it. So there's a real paradox.
Yeah. And that's the Toledo, like the Great Black Swamp, right? Like they talked about the unhardening of that. Like they've, you know, and that was what he was saying. He's like, there's going to be something where it's like, are we going to take these people's hundreds of years of work to turn it into valuable farmland for their families, and then say we got to take it away because
it's
our water.
It's dicey stuff, you know. And I don't profess to have, like, it's not prescriptive. It's not like we got to do this and right. that, or we're all screwed. It's you know, it's kind of we're all screwed, but we should look at maybe. And I don't think we're, I mean, I just think that there's a, so like historically pre-human, early human, you know, phosphorus just naturally cycled through the environment and it was used over and over and over again. And a good way to illustrate that is just to think about a cow in a pasture. And a cow eats grass, poops, that poop grows grass, the cow eats it, and on and on and on. And those phosphorus molecules just cycle over and over and over again. It's the circle of life, literally. And we cracked that circle and turned it into a straight line when we figured out we didn't need just manure or, you know, crops tilled back into the land. We could get these rocks, soak them in acid, and unleash them on a field, and it'll make, you know, corn stalks grow to apple tree heights. And so, yeah, it's been a spectacular discovery and, you know, a great success story. But we've got to get away from this linear thinking where it's, you know, throw as much as you want on your crop. Whatever the crop doesn't take up will wash away and you can do it again next year, because we got plenty of the stuff, not just the stuff coming out of the ground, but also now increasingly manure from these CAFOs, these factory farms. They produce ungodly amounts of manure every day, and that's got to go somewhere. And too often it's just going on a landscape that may not need that nutrient infusion. And so what does it do? It does what everything else does. It rolls downhill. And in Western Ohio, that is Lake Erie. And so Lake Erie's getting just completely fouled. And the farmers are, you know, they recognize there's a problem. But there was a study out of Ohio State about a decade ago, and I'll botch the numbers, but the gist of it was 75% of the farmers believe that farming is causing harm to Lake Erie, but 75% of the farmers also believe they're not the ones who are doing it. And so, you know, I mean, what's more noble than growing food? And, you know, most of these guys and women are not getting, you know, rich off of this. They're just trying to stay in business, but the system's not working. It's not working for the water, and it's not really working for them. Here in Wisconsin, just this summer, they were running some 35,000 gallons of milk through the sewage treatment plant in July for a number of days, because we were producing more milk than there was market for. And so it's got to go somewhere. So it was going in Lake Michigan.
Wow.
Which is absurd. Yeah. It's just absurd. And so I guess my argument in the book is, let's figure out how to, you know, update the Clean Water Act, which never really addressed agriculture. And for a good reason at the time, because in the 1960s and 70s, the big polluters were smokestacks and pipes. Mm. And this agriculture pollution known as non-point source pollution in regulatory parlance was considered too insignificant and too difficult to capture and treat, because you can't really squeegee what's a farm field. You know, stuff's going to leach off. But things have changed in the half century since we got the Clean Water Act, and the farms have gotten a lot bigger. And it could be argued they are by now point source polluters, and those manure pits shouldn't be just, you know, drained and dumped on the landscape. They should be, you know, exploited or mined for the nutritional trove that they are. I mean, if the British could have seen these lagoons filled with manure in the 1800s when they're, you know, throwing anything they can think of on the ground to make things grow, they would not look at that as yuck. They'd be like, yum. You know, yeah. There's a lot of food in that. And so what would this mean regulatorily? I mean, I guess one cow produces, like, I think as much waste as 18 human beings. And then you have, you know, factory farms that have 10,000 head of cattle. So these are like city-sized operations when it comes to the manure that they generate, and it doesn't go through treatment. And I think it could be argued that maybe it's time to look at putting it through treatment. And would that cost money? Yeah, but there are costs that we're suffering right now in terms of not being able to swim. I was at Maumee Bay State Park over by Toledo just a few weeks ago. So it was early October, and a glorious 82, 83 degree day. The water temperature was in the 70s, and nobody was in the beach because the beach was polluted because of phosphorus runoff into the lake. So I guess, you know, thinking, first of all, there's farms here in Wisconsin now that we had a story in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel last year that this one farm was, they installed an anaerobic digester to pull the methane out of their manure. And they were making as much money, $350,000 a year, selling that methane than they were on selling their milk.
Wow.
Which is kind of crazy. Yeah. Now, if you've got your hands on this stuff, if you can pull the methane out, you can pull the phosphorus out. You can treat it so it's like in pelletized form, pure as anything that's, you know, coming from a farmer's co-op, and you can move it around. Right now, the farmers say it's too expensive to move manure more than like 10 miles from where it was produced because it's just too big of an expense. So what's it going to mean? I mean, maybe the price of milk has to go up, but that would be, you know, a cost not just borne on the farmers, but on everybody. Yeah. Right.
And I mean, you're doing a good job of summing up a lot of these chapters in this book. You really do take a very cool way to get to a lot of these stories, like even the Iowa, you know, State Fair. It's like something that we all know about. We hear about it every year.
Yeah. You know, that was just a stab in the dark. I was over at Madison at the University of Wisconsin. I think this was summer, August of 2019. And I was talking to this undergraduate student who was doing some testing on Lake Mendota, which is a spectacular lake right on the University of Wisconsin campus. And it's also the most studied lake in the world, probably because the university's renowned Center for Limnology, which is the study of freshwater sciences, has been there for 100 plus years, I believe. And so that lake's been studied upside down and across over and over again. And they know exactly what the problem is. It's too much manure in the watershed because they have like swimming docks right at the student union. And, you know, in years prior, those kids were, there's lifeguard stations. I mean, they expected kids to be swimming in those waters. And today they rarely do. I was mentioning sometimes I have interactions with comedians, and I had one such interaction back in August this year. I met this guy named Charlie Behrens. Have you ever heard of him?
No.
Oh, no. He's famous for being like Mr. Wisconsin. He's got the heavy Wisconsin twang. He mocks in a loving, tender, funny way our culture. Just the culture of the upper Midwest. It would resonate with you guys. If you Google him. Yeah. Charlie Behrens, B-E-R-E-N-S. Anyway, he's quite a well-known comic around here. And I actually met him on the streets of London last year when I went over for a Packer game. And he's famous to the point where, you know, you see him on the street and there's people lined up to get pictures. So I introduced myself, and it turned out that he has quite an interest in water. So by the by, we end up meeting on the stage on the shore of Lake Mendota at the University of Wisconsin Student Union with a soil scientist, or with a agronomist, I believe he was, and then a limnologist. And the whole idea was to talk about, look, this lake has been studied to death, and it's also beloved, and this university is an academic powerhouse. If we can't figure out how to fix this problem on this one lake, what chance do we have for any other lake? And then the day when I gave the talk, I noted, I'm like, feel, you know, this is August 31st, still remember the day, and it was in the 80s, and there were tons of kids on a dock. None of them were in the water. 2 days later, there were so many kids on that dock, it's an aluminum seasonal dock, it collapsed, and nobody died or was severely hurt, but they could have been. But those kids were thrust into the water. Now, they should have been in the water swimming to begin with, you know? It's just kind of, it's things are upside down in a way right now, where, you know, all these guys go to the beach and all they do is sit on the dock to the point that there's so many of them the dock collapses. There's a message in there somewhere.
Yeah, I work on a lake, so I know what you mean. No one goes in Lake Erie. They got boat. I work where there's a bunch of boats and stuff, so you don't see or hear anyone going in Lake Erie because it's kind of dirty.
Yeah, you know, it's a shame because I live just a few blocks from Lake Michigan, and my kids are older now. The youngest is 15 and the oldest is 22. But when, you know, they were, you know, in the single digits and early teens, I just made sure that we, you know, they test the water and you go down and, you know, see the signs posted okay. And it's like, we're going in the water because those kids need to swim for those kids to have a relationship with the lake so they'll care about it. So the lake has a constituency in the next generation. And that's kind of what happened to me. I spent so much time on Lake Michigan that when I got free rein to write the stories I wanted, I wrote about Lake Michigan because I love that lake. And you're not going to love it if you don't have exposure and experiences with it.
Yeah, I forced my daughter into the lake.
There you go.
The guy that made me aware of the importance of the lake was the late, great Gordon Downie from the rock band The Tragically Hip. And he was a water keeper. And he always had this great quote, and I'm going to read it to you. The lake is our identity. When we harm water, we harm ourselves. And it's pretty powerful that we take for granted. I think what he's trying to say is we take for granted and we shouldn't be harming our lakes anymore.
Yeah, you know, I'm looking at Lake Michigan. I'm in my car right now in a parking lot at a park overlooking Lake Michigan. And it's because I have a yappy dog and I didn't want that to ruin your podcast.
Oh, thanks, man.
Yeah, no problem. But yeah, you know, his point resonates with me, and I've heard it put this way. You know, the human body is like 80 or 90% water. And if you live in Milwaukee, your water comes from Lake Michigan. So 80 to 90% of you is that lake that you drive by every day. And you take care of that lake, not just because it has intrinsic value, but because it's who you are physically, literally. Yeah. And that's a pretty heavy, soulful thought.
Another Gordon Downie one is, you are not the ocean, you are just a lake.
That's right.
Well, the best Great Lakes quote I ever heard was Keith Richards. What the hell he knows about Lake Superior or why he's talking about Lake Superior, I have no idea. This is in the Great Lakes book, I believe. But he was talking about the business empire juggernaut that is Rolling Stones, Inc. And he said, there's so much that, you know, goes on that people don't even see. He's like, it's like you go to Lake Superior and you look across all that water and you think, man, that's a lot of water. And then you realize, and that's just the top. I don't know what that means, but I think I know what he's saying. Yeah, it's hilarious. Right.
And growing up, I was always told Lake Erie was the dead lake. And you've brought this up. We are, you know, Dr. Seuss. They will walk on their fins and get woefully weary and some of... in search of some water that isn't so smeary.
Yeah, that was 1972, 73, right when we got the Clean Water Act, but before it took effect. Yeah. And then by 1985, they so reduced the amount of phosphorus going into that lake. At that time, it was primarily coming from laundry detergents because laundry detergents were like largely a box of phosphorus. And that was growing all this algae. And so they pulled phosphorus from, you know, formulas like Tide. And by 1985, Lake Erie was, you know, largely healed. And Dr. Seuss literally, you know, he pulled that line from the Lorax because Lake Erie had improved. If he was still alive, he may put that line back in, because Lake Erie's turning into a mess again, and this time it's not from factories, it's from agriculture runoff.
Yeah, what could a regular ham and egger like us, what could we do to improve our lake? Just
you know,
what organizations? I don't know.
Is there any organization that gives directly to like things that do things for the lake? I'm not even positive.
Well, you know, I'm reluctant to, because I'm a journalist and I don't want to advocate for certain enterprises, and you know that some of them could be controversial. But I think that what you can do is you get educated and you realize that there is a very intimate tie between what goes on the land and what grows in the water. And then bend your legislators' ears and meet with like-minded people, which, you know, Google search will steer you in that direction. But too many people, now the whole point of this book, this phosphorus book, is really to connect the dots, to paint a picture that isn't really obvious and isn't typically in the news. People hear about toxic algae outbreaks, but they don't really have an understanding of what's causing them and how they can be fixed. And that's going to change just because this problem is getting worse. As you know, the planet warms. The algae loves the warmer temperatures. There's been studies indicating that they may be thriving in the increased carbon that's in the atmosphere. And there's just more people, and they want to be around lakes. I went down to Florida again this summer to Lake Okeechobee in the middle of the state to do a story for the New York Times about how polluted Lake Okeechobee had become, and to keep that lake from bursting its artificial banks and flooding and killing thousands of people, they keep sending contaminated water down canals to the Gulf Coast and the Atlantic Coast. So you got these people in these communities downstream from Lake Okeechobee, you know, saying, what the heck are you guys sending this toxic stuff our way? And, you know, it starts with what's going on the land way, way upstream. And Florida is not adequately addressing that at this point. And it's, you know, it's biting them. It's not going to come back to biting them. It's biting them.
Have you ever heard the term climate refugee?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Is that ever a potential? I mean, it's so much.
I don't know. I mean, it intuitively it makes a lot of sense. It's like, yeah, I'm going to go someplace where there's a lot of water and it's cold, because pretty soon it's not going to be so cold. Like Marquette, Michigan, up on the Upper Peninsula, that is a place that people commonly talk about as a climate refuge. People have also talked about Chicago. I did another story for the New York Times back in 2021. And Chicago is uniquely exposed to climate change, as are most Great Lakes cities, because I don't know the history of the swings on Lake Ontario, but you guys on Lake Erie, you fluctuate pretty much the same way Lakes Michigan and Huron do. And that means, you know, over the course of decades, the lake can go from, you know, it can swing 6 feet, you know, as far as its height against the land. But if it goes more than 6 feet, you've got flooding, bad flooding in Chicago in particular, because that was built on a swamp. And if it goes less, you're threatening drinking water intakes. You're obviously threatening navigation. And then the lake starts getting warmer, and the shallower they get. And that poses another set of problems. So we're kind of in the Great Lakes. It sounds great that we have all this water and that we have cold winters, but you know, Chicago, Lake Michigan went, I think it was at its all-time low, or within a millimeter or something of it, in 2013. And by 2019, it was within a millimeter of its all-time high. So that's 6 feet.
It's just going to
swell. And they talk about, a six-foot bump. And, you know, they talk about what's happening with the oceans. And, you know, yeah, the oceans are getting, you know, the water level's creeping up, but it's happening very incrementally, and it's happening in one direction, up, up, up. In the Great Lakes, because of climate change, we got to worry about water going up. And so in the ocean, they say, oh, maybe a foot or two in a century. So we got 6 feet in 5 years.
Yeah.
And there's nothing saying that it has to stop there. We could have gotten 8 feet. If we got 8 feet, Chicago is in big, big trouble. Big trouble. I mean, already where it was in 2021, they were flooding downtown, and you put another foot or two on top of that, and it's a nightmare.
Well, I'm sorry. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. No, that's all I got.
No, the problem that this time of year, we all look at the lake now, and we look at it, and this is Lake Erie, and we say, well, that ain't going to freeze. We're so fucked because that lake effect snow comes, and I don't know if you've seen what happened to us last year, but
yeah.
The lake giveth and she take it away real quick.
Yeah, well, and a lot of that, you know, falls inside the basin, so if it doesn't go back into Lake Erie, it may go into Lake Ontario, but it's kind of staying in the system. But yeah, you want that lake to freeze.
Yeah.
On the other hand, we don't, the reason the Lake Michigan went up so fast, like around 2021, was two out of 3 years, I think, were polar vortex years. So yeah. Lake Michigan normally doesn't freeze over, but both those years it was over 90% frozen. And because of that, that really tamps down the evaporation. So the lake level gets a lot higher, and that's what drove that. So, you know, that polar vortex is a function of just a destabilized climate, and it's just that tight swirl around the Arctic poles, or the poles, the Arctic pole specifically, goes wobbly, and it sends all that cold air south, and that sends our lake water straight up. And now, the lake, I don't remember what the numbers were, but we had a warm summer up here, and we had a warm lake. And that's going to mean it's going to take longer for it to freeze. So then it's not going to freeze as completely as it might have 30, 40 years ago. And so that can lead to more instability.
Yeah, and start stretching because you're going to be shoveling.
Yeah. And, how do you guys deal with that? I mean, I've seen...
Oh, gosh.
Booze.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, just sharing. I mean,
like, because we don't... Shoot, I'm going to guess what our average inch total in snowfall... It'd probably be 30 or 40 inches or something. And so most people I know like snow. They don't like the morning of shoveling, but they like, if you're going to have winter, you might as well have snow.
Yeah. I mean, it's cool, but like, don't put our Bills games in the Detroit Dome and not give us a dome. You know? Like, what are we doing? We're just going to go to Detroit every time it snows here.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. That's right. You guys had to play.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. I mean, you know, it's, well, we're already struggling.
Do you remember when the Humphrey Dome in Minneapolis?
Oh, yeah, it collapsed. Yeah.
It collapsed. There was so much snow. It was like some kind of polyurethane cap on it. And, it was like a souffle. Too much snow, and it just collapsed.
Yeah, you might really like Jim's comedy. All he does is make fun of the late, great Jim Kelly there.
Oh, he's still alive.
Yeah, nah, but he was not great anymore.
Yeah, he's just not great anymore. It's tough around here. I think the biggest thing with the snow now, and we're older, getting older and cranky, is like everything's closed. The plows aren't working, and now
there's speed bumps everywhere.
There's speed bumps everywhere. It's not the snow. It's everything that comes with the snow. I could deal with the snow, but they just shut everything down now.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'd imagine too, since COVID, snow day isn't always a snow day, you know. If there's too much for too long, it's like, yeah, kids, listen, you don't go outside
PTSD.
And have a snowball fight. You got to sit there and study on a screen.
Dan, you should see the bars here when snowstorms come. They run out of beer.
Well, you guys just got to plan better.
I know.
Yeah, well, I think your books are a really great place to start to get to know what's going on. I mean, this is a really good approach. Like, I'm telling you, like, I can't read science-y stuff, but the way that you put it down, you know, it's like, I don't know if you ever read, like, Graham Hancock or, like, Tom O'Neill. It's like, you have a really good way to take science and, you know, not make it seem like it's a conspiracy theory, I guess, you know?
Yeah, thanks. I think that's just kind of the journalism background where I was saying earlier, you got to write in a very simple, straightforward way. And assume nothing of the audience.
And we'll definitely hook you up with Lieutenant Colonel Kobe Krug, send him the information. He's fascinating. You might need him for another book. But check out.
Do you have anything on the horizon? Are you still working? Is it just back to the grind?
Yeah, I'm not working on another book right now. This one just came out in March, and I've been pretty busy just promoting it. And like I mentioned before, I did a pretty long piece for the Times this summer, and I'm maybe going to do a magazine piece in a month or two. And I get the energy. I'm 56, so I've still got some gas in the tank. But I want to be strategic if I'm going to embark on another book, which is, you know, at least 2 years of your life, probably three or four or five.
I mean, but you're taking on all the knowledge, all this, you know, do you feel like it's sort of like a burden now? Like you're like, I got to keep going. Can't change the direction.
A little bit, you know, but the thing is like, I'm not a scientist who is just, you know, trying to share what I know with the public. I'm a member of the public trying to get a scientist to explain stuff to me, to us, the public. Mm-hmm. So, I really like, it takes a lot to, I a lot of times people want me to talk like I'm some kind of Great Lakes expert, and I am compared to a normal person, but not compared to, you know, all the scientists at all the research universities in the Midwest. I just, you know, I'm an interpreter. So a lot of times people will expect me to, you know everything about everything. And I basically have to say, look, what I know is between, you know what I know if you read the book.
Right,
it's between those covers. And it's a little embarrassing in some ways, but it's honest. It's like, you know, this is just what I learned from talking to people. And I don't have a lot more insight beyond what I've shared. So why I need to keep moving and doing something else, you know, doing something new, not new, different from the lakes. It'll probably be lake related, but
do some stand-up comedy.
I was at a comedy show with my wife and a friend of mine. We had gone to dinner, and my friend had been out earlier, and he had eaten a THC gummy, which are
I have no idea.
Totally legal here, you know.
Okay, yeah. Well, they're legal in Illinois, which is like 70 miles from where we were having dinner. So I guess he was breaking the law, but yeah, he was blissed out, I guess I'd say. And this guy got up, and my friend started he was just laughing too hard at like all at anything, and he was disruptive to the set, to the point where I said, "You crocker, you got to go." And this was outdoor on a rooftop, and dude, you gotta leave until you get yourself back together. And so he goes in and, you know, spends 10 minutes just kind of composing himself. And then he comes back out, and the comic's still going. And somebody says, some one of his friends or family members says something about the Great Lakes. Well, it turns out this guy's a naturalist. And he's like, oh, you want to? And so he had some bit about the Great Lakes. We never got to it because he's like, first of all, how many people here think they know how deep Lake Michigan is? And my friend had just gotten back in, and he's like, oh, now you're in trouble. He's like, this guy wrote the book.
And the poor literally.
The poor comic just kind of stops, and he looks, and he says, are you Dan Egan? And
oh,
like,
no way.
I'm not, so somebody people know. They may know the book, but they typically don't know who I am. And I was like, yeah. And he's like, I love your book.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's something we didn't talk about. You were nominated for 2 Pulitzer Prize and lost both times to the whole entire staff of the New York Times.
Yeah, you saw that somewhere? Yeah, yeah. That's
how the fuck does that happen?
That's not a fair fight.
No, it wasn't. Yeah, I can't remember. Like, yeah, the second time. So, yeah, you get nominated, and, you know, you can get nominated every year, but then there's finalists. So there's, for each category, there's probably 10 or 11 categories. There's 3 finalists, 1 winner. And so, yeah, this one year, I was writing about the Chicago water situation, the Chicago River and these Asian carp. And it was just my story. I actually wrote it as my thesis out at Columbia University. And the team that won was like the New York Times staff for reporting on Apple's, like, supply chain and working conditions around the globe. I mean, there were dozens of people. I don't know if there were dozens.
There's a whole team. There's a whole building.
Yeah. Inspiring. So anyway, but just real quickly back to this comedian. Turns out he's a naturalist, and I had my book release launch up at the, it's called the Schlitz Audubon Center. It's like this nature preserve just north of Milwaukee. And, they asked if I would do it there, and I said, only if you have AJ, and I can't remember his last name, the comedian, do the interview, because I owe him for messing up his set.
Oh, that's awesome.
With my friend. So, and yeah, he did a great job, and I think, you know, comedy is a good way to get people who wouldn't normally be interested in something like phosphorus or water levels. You want to make this stuff accessible to people and explain to them why they should be paying attention and maybe doing something about it. And humor is a good way to convey that.
Absolutely. Well, the new book is called The Devil's Element, Phosphorus in a World Out of Balance. A new friend of the program, Dan Egan. And Dan, you're ever in the Lake Erie area or Buffalo, we'll take care of you, take you out.
Yeah, his restaurant's really nice.
Yeah, and until then, Dan Egan, you are now licensed to talk. Thank you very much.
Thanks, guys. That was a fun time.
All right. Great. Peace, brother.